Welcome to the Religious Studies Project, hosted by David Robertson and myself, Christopher Cotter. This podcast is produced in association with the British Association for the Study of Religions, and you can visit our website at www.religiousstudiesproject.com.
Astrology is a massive business worldwide. If statistics are to be believed, then close to 100% of people in Britain know their sun sign. But what exactly is astrology? What is its relationship to modernity, to scientific thought? Is it merely a bizarre survival from some sort of medieval worldview, or does it have more to tell us about the nature of popular vernacular religion? To discuss that with me today, I'm joined by Dr. Nick Campion, who is Senior Lecturer in Archaeology and Anthropology at University of Wales, Trinity St. David, and he's also Director of the Sophia Centre for the Study of Cosmology and Culture. His most recent book is Astrology and Popular Religion in the Modern West, and he's also recently published Astrology and Cosmology in the World's Religion. So welcome to the Religious Studies Project.
Thank you.
If we could start just really by establishing what it is we're talking about. What's the field? What is astrology?
I define astrology very broadly as the quest for meaning in the sky. We can have inclusive or exclusive definitions of astrology just like we can of religion. And so all cultures look for meaning in the sky, and they have resulting practices and traditions and rituals and rites and forms of social organisation. There's also a narrower definition which everybody needs to be aware of because it occurs through the literature, which is that astrology is primarily a discipline invented in classical Greece and which involves the use of the 12 zodiac signs with which we're familiar, okay, and the planets to make predictions, analyse human destiny.
And that Greek kind of solar astrology, the narrower sense that you defined it there, what relationship is that to the astrology that we see in the modern West?
Well, the astrology we see in the modern West has to be understood in its popular form and also the way in which it's approached by a very small number of practitioners. So the popular form, which is huge, is found in the horoscope columns in newspapers and magazines and now all over the web, and that's the language of the 12 zodiac signs. I think that's huge. My sense is that the vast majority of people are inclined to give that kind of astrology some credence, although the figures for so-called belief tend to be quite a bit lower. But that's huge. It's a part of popular culture, and I think it's a part of popular culture that we could equate to, say, an assumption there's such a thing as gravity, and if you drop an apple, it falls to the earth, or the monarchy is generally a good thing. There's a background soup of ideas which we accept in popular culture. And then there's a very small number of practitioners and students and amateurs who will follow the tradition developed in ancient Greece, in which a complicated horoscope is created using all the zodiac signs, all the planets, and probably a multitude of other factors as well. And there's very intricate rules for interpreting this. And this is a tradition which extends back 2,000 to 2,500 years in unbroken practice.
Is that what we know as sidereal? Is that how you pronounce it?
No. Sidereal astrology, sometimes a name given to Indian astrology, just means the astrology of the stars.
Oh, yeah.
And the distinction that's made between Indian and Western astrology is that the zodiac signs, which are used in the West, gradually shift against the background of the stars. And what that means is that even though the system used in India and the system used in the West have a shared origin 2,000 to 2,500 years ago, and they still have many similarities, the technical basis has shifted. And so if you are born under a particular zodiac sign in the West, it's most likely your zodiac sign in India is the next sign is different.
Yeah, okay. So they've taken the precession of the equinoxes into account and we haven't, or is it the other way around?
They've taken it into account. Okay. They've taken the movement of the stars into account and we haven't.
And now that's interesting because astrology is often thought of as a very Western phenomenon. But so you're saying there's an Indian astrology? Is it a worldwide phenomenon?
I think it's a worldwide phenomenon because I take a broad definition. But I use now a typology I've taken from Cieliada, who talks about cosmic and chaotic cosmogonies. So for Eliade, in a cosmic cosmogony, there's a creator. So classically, the Abrahamic faiths, God calls or the universe into existence or creates it. And in chaotic cosmogonies, the cosmos develops out of a formless nothing or something. It comes out of chaos in the Greek version. And so I looked at world astrologies as these two types. You have a cosmic astrology, which is highly codified, very structured, with very strict rules of interpretation. And you'll find such forms in the West, in India, in Mesoamerica, the Aztec and Maya systems, and in China. Mm-hmm. And so there are basically three systems there, completely different technical systems, the Chinese, the Indian / European, and the Mesoamerican. And then there are those in which you get a much greater level of spontaneity, I'm calling chaotic. And the two overlap, naturally. Mm-hmm. All models are just models, and the boundaries are blurred. But the difference would be, for example, that say in India, let's say, you have to wait for a particular planetary configuration to perform a particular ritual.
Yeah, yeah.
However, in South America, say there's a need for a puberty ritual, and you're waiting for a particular star to rise. Well, if that star doesn't rise, another rising star will do. So it's the ritual that's more important, the human activity that's more important in that case, rather than the astronomical configuration.
Okay, do we see a reassessment then in the Enlightenment period and afterwards, where the emergence of evolutionism and then later the Big Bang, where Western astrology kind of reinterprets itself to fit in with a more chaotic emerging cosmology?
Not quite, but I think that's an interesting question, because the Enlightenment is a complicated phenomenon, and you know the notion of the Enlightenment as some sort of peculiar triumph of reason is now being questioned, because, well, in the 18th century, Rosicrucianism flourished, occult and esoteric forms of Freemasonry flourished frequently amongst the people who were the advocates of reason. And that's not a problem if we realise that the veneration for reason partly comes from Plato, and for Plato, what function does reason perform? It's a way of taking us closer to the divine. Mm-hmm. And in Plato, the path of divine can lie via the stars. So the Enlightenment is a phenomenon which I think we need to revisit, but combined with developments in technology and mathematics in the 17th and 18th centuries, there was definitely change in the way people in the West saw the universe. I try to avoid the word science, by the way. We've got technology, the use of the telescope beginning around 1610, really the first publication of telescopic observations around 1610. For the first time, people could look directly at the sky, and the old cosmology collapsed. There were no solid crystalline spheres in which the planets revolved. There was no perfection up there. People could see craters on Mars, the rings of Saturn. All these things completely challenged the old view. And so astrology had to be reviewed. In addition to this, there was the discovery that the Sun is the centre of the solar system. But what happened was a long process. To start off with, most people in the West couldn't have cared less about the Enlightenment. Right? So at a popular level, astrology continued in an unbroken lineage down to the present day. So if you're reading a horoscope column, you're looking at a form of vernacular folk wisdom that's traced back to the classical world, the ancient Near East, in an unbroken tradition. It's not a survival. Let's say it's just always it's always been there. It was never challenged. At the elite level, a couple of interesting things happened. To start off with, there were attempts to create a new astrology based on empirical observation and based on an understanding of Newtonian laws and the mechanical universe. And they take us down to mesmerism and the beginnings of hypnotism, because Franz Mesmer, who developed what we now know as hypnotism, thought that the planets' movements had an effect on the animal magnetism, which he thought pervaded the universe, which could be used for healing.
It's a sort of etheric kind of idea.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so even though Mesmer rejected the word astrology, it is that's a kind of naturalistic astrology. Then we have the development of esoteric currents amongst the elite, leading particularly into esoteric and occult currents in Freemasonry, whereby, and coming out of Neoplatonism. So the whole Neoplatonic tradition, going back to the classical world, tended to reject the kind of popular astrology which might forecast your death, your marriage, the number of children you're going to have. That's street astrology. It rejected that. But it maintained a high reverence for the sacredness of the universe and the stars as an image of divinity, maybe the stars as a symbolic or imaginal path to the divine. And these ideas were preserved, and they survive in theosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have a tradition there which takes us through to people like Rudolf Steiner.
Indeed.
And theosophists, yeah. And anthroposophical movement.
And we'll get to that, the roots of that leading into the New Age soon, but I want to just return back to the idea of the reassessment, because it seems to me that the earlier sort of astrology is based on a clockwork kind of model of the universe, that, you know, everything's moving and it's set, so you can read exactly what the state of the system is from those, as you said, you know, the spheres moving. Whereas later, in the kind of theosophical world, astrology maybe appealed to the the hermetic, as above, so below. So it's not so much that you're reading the workings of a detailed system, rather like, say, the I Ching or something. It's a way of reading general currents that are going on. That's just a...
I mean, you're right, but this debate as to how precise astrology can be and how precisely it can measure, say, an individual life, this debate goes back to the late classical period.
Okay.
Because, and we go back to Plato. Actually, coming out of Plato, we get competing ideas. See, Plato said that as the planets move, they may create time, or they mark time, it depends how you translate it, but they become extremely important as timers. At the same time, Plato is rejecting empirical observation, precise measurement, and talking in myth and allegory. So you've got kind of two kinds of Platonism. And these get debated in the under the Roman period by the Neoplatonic philosophers, who themselves reject the astrology that you would have encountered in the Roman Empire, where you could go along and have your horoscope cast and you're told, you know, next year X, Y, and Z are going to happen at certain dates. They reject that kind of astrology and instead develop a sort of theurgic astrology designed to, through symbol, through ritual magic, through meditation, enable the soul to unite with the divine. And so that Neoplatonic astrology is what then resurfaces very strongly through Theosophy, through the Golden Dawn. So it never goes away. And it can, and then again we get different subcurrents there. You get the ritual magicians who will draw a pentagram and stand inside it and try and invoke planetary angels, as opposed to others who find that kind of activity rather debased and instead will focus on meditation, for example. So there's a constant interplay of competing currents, and they're all still very active at the moment. A lot of the people involved in paganism and magic are trained in the complex practices of astrology. Others tend to reject it because they take the view that, which I think is erroneous, that astrology is far too concerned with passive interpretation or passive prediction, whereas the magical and pagan traditions are far more concerned with action. So again, within the pagan and magical worlds, we get these debates and competing points of view as well.
Yeah, right across that milieu, from the more sort of mind, body, spirit, holistic end of the New Age spectrum, right over to the more active, magical end of the pagan spectrum, there's this underlying common epistemological ground that the world is, or the cosmos is intimately connected, and that everything in it has meaning. And I think that's why astrology appeals right across that board.
I think the appeal of astrology in the modern world is purely to do with meaning. What it does is it keeps the individual at the centre of the universe. And so in a cosmos which is huge and impersonal, and we're told we live on a tiny star on the edge of a spiral arm on a small galaxy and so on, or where psychology is often a matter of abstract types, and often quite alien to individuals, astrology has a form of popular psychology which is quite rich. It's anthropomorphized, it's personalized. So to give an example, in a great and influential book on sun sign astrology in the 1970s, Linda Goodman, whose book was a million seller in the 1970s, has chapters saying, you know, your Taurian boss, your Taurian wife, your Taurian husband. It's all personalised. Back in the 1930s, the first astrologer to run a regular newspaper column, and this is in the Sunday Express, had features on Mr. and Mrs. Gemini, Mr. and Mrs. Cancer. So it's personalised. And everybody can locate themselves in the system. All you need to know is when your birthday is. And then you can buy a book, or you can look on the web and you can find out that you are sensitive or creative or assertive or whatever, and that you are compatible with other signs. And no other form of psychology, no other form of analysis of the human condition comes anywhere near doing this. They don't even try to do it. And so even though astrology is criticized for creating these 12 categories, I mean, my retort to that is actually, that's more categories than most systems have.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it's equivalent to the Jung one that everybody uses, isn't it? It's
16 is Jung in the Myers-Briggs.
That's the one, yeah.
Well, you see, that's interesting, because I call that a form of disguised astrology, because Myers-Briggs, which is the typology so much used in management, training, recruitment, and so on,
yeah,
is derived from Jung.
Yeah.
And Jung is deriving his system from medieval alchemy.
Yeah.
In fact, Jung is also reading the theosophical astrologers of the early 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't cite them. Jung, in his footnotes, likes to cite medieval manuscripts.
Yeah.
What he doesn't cite, but what was in his library, works by people like Alan Leo, who was the most important theosophical astrologer of the late 19th, early 20th century, and was arguing strongly that astrology is not about prediction, it's about development of the soul.
Mm-hmm.
And Leo had a massive influence on the whole discipline. Jung was reading it. So
Jung, of course, has the same underlying assumption of a sort of collective epistemological ground underneath, and writes about meaningful coincidences.
Yeah, no, I mean, Jung, in my view, is just a thoroughgoing Neoplatonist. You know, there's all this rhetoric about wanting psychology to be a science, but again, you know, science is a difficult word, which I try not to use, but still, whatever way you look at it, Jung is taking his theories of psychology from classical Neoplatonism.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly, so he's working exactly parallel to the Theosophists and Steiner and Alice Bailey and so on. He's just a very much more articulate view of the same. But in fact, Jung gave modern astrology an intelligent voice, in my view, because his work is articulate and thoughtful and so on, whereas I think that Rudolf Steiner, who I'd see as a very parallel figure to Jung, Steiner's pretty impenetrable.
Yeah.
So I think even probably for a lot of anthroposophists, they probably don't really manage to get into him that much. But whereas Jung has the gift of communicating universal truths in a particular way.
Yeah, and Jung, through Joseph Campbell and others, and his comparative method as well, legitimizes the whole it's whatever works for you kind of comparative religion of that baby boomer generation, which feeds deeply into the new age.
He does. In fact, one of the things I found in my research into modern astrology is that the whatever works for you hypothesis is incredibly strong. So in astrology, there are very precise techniques, and medieval and classical astrology, you would have found that if you want to make predictions for somebody or describe their character or something, you have to follow very precise rules and very complex rules. And those rules are still there. But if you ask modern astrologers, when you read a horoscope, do you use the techniques which work for you? The vast majority will say yes to that. And there are actually precedents for that going back to medieval astrology, well, via back into Neoplatonism. And the reason is that if God is the ultimate authority on all matters, then you can only make precise astrological predictions if you are inspired by God.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, probably before an astrological consultation, you should pray,
mm-hmm.
for example. And so the whatever works for you formula is also, it's particularly in vogue at the moment, but it's also grounded in ancient philosophy. It goes back to Plato.
And you find that there's often an element when somebody will be doing an astrological reading that they'll claim intuition was you know, or they had a feeling or whatever. You find that in yep. many of these divinatory systems.
Massive. Intuition is... intuition is huge.
Mm. Like the signs or the tarot cards or the particular I Ching character that you've got give you a guide, but it's your intuition how you interpret the whole yeah. thing together. Yeah.
And there's also a relativism there, which I think has come out of the... increasing awareness over the last century and a half by Western astrologers of Indian astrology. Mm. And the problem of Indian astrology working on a different technical basis because of the shift of the zodiac signs. And that's a problem that has to be answered. And the way it's answered is by saying that all paths lead to the truth. And therefore, astrology, for some astrologers coming out of the theosophical tradition, then becomes not a guide to truth in itself, but a purely relative means of understanding the real spiritual truths. And for some astrologers, that relates to your level of evolution. So there was an astrologer called Dame Rudyard in the USA, probably the most influential American astrologer of the 20th century, a devout theosophist, student of Alice Bailey. And he develops the idea, combining Jung with Blavatsky, that you can develop an astrology that can enable people to grow and develop, based on Jung. So you'll use Jung and other depth psychologists to enable people to grow and develop, and that will then serve the functions of Blavatskyan spiritual evolution.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you evolve, and as you evolve, the astrology of fate that previously governed you no longer operates, and so before you grew psychologically and spiritually, if you were Taurus, you would just be stubborn.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas once you've evolved, if you're Taurus, then the spirituality of the Taurus, which might, for example, be nurturing, opens a path for your spiritual evolution.
Yeah, yeah.
And then ultimately, once you've gone down that path, then the transpersonal takes over and you're reabsorbed into the cosmos.
Yeah.
And you no longer have any individuality. But, so... So that leads then a lot of astrologers to say, well, astrology works in a certain sense if you are an unaware individual, unevolved, and you'll be subject to fate.
Yeah.
And so if you have a particular planetary alignment, you will break your leg or get divorced or whatever. But if you are aware, astrology then just becomes not a guide to objective truth, but it's a set of symbols which you can use to grow and have learning opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
I think that opens up problematic areas because it leads to, it's very elitist.
Yeah.
And so I've never met anybody who believed in spiritual evolution who didn't think they were evolved.
Yeah.
They always think they're evolved and other people are not so evolved.
Yeah.
And that's problematic because if you look at the behaviour of the people who claim to be evolved, you probably won't find it any different to the behaviour of the people they think aren't evolved.
Right.
And so it's
frequently worse.
And so, you know, I think there's an area of study there for keen PhD students who want to look at New Age spirituality. I don't know if anybody's yet done that or is looking at it. In fact, this whole area, I have to say, because it's so ignored, is rich in potential research projects.
Mm-hmm.
Very rich. You can do research projects which maybe some thought, well, as you can across the field of new religious movements.
Yeah.
So-called alternative spirituality.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was going to ask you about that anyway, about the issues around studying as you said, a little studied field, but also I think a field that's quite difficult methodologically. I mean, because you're mixing historical research, but presumably there's ethnographic aspects to your work as well.
Methodologically, well, you know, we've created a master's degree, which I'm calling Cultural Astronomy and Astrology. That's a problematic title because, you know, astronomy and astrology are supposed to be at war with each other in Western society.
Mm-hmm.
So I put the word culture in front, and astronomy has a culture, astrology has a culture, and anyway, in any other culture, apart from the modern West, the two words have no distinct meaning.
But you must be getting that question all the time. I mean, you know.
Do you know what? I tend not to get the question, and the reason is because on my website, or the university website, it's carefully explained why we're using this term.
Right.
So I think people probably get there and then don't ask the question. I mean, the big problem, which I guess comes across the study of religions area, is the question of truth. Now, the development of the discipline is largely influenced by the study of religions, which is quite anthropological. Students go and do field work, maybe the odd questionnaire, but emphasis on interviews and participant observations. So we do that, but personally, I was actually originally a historian, and I've got prejudices there. I think it's impossible to understand the present without an understanding of the past. So our methodology is jointly historical and anthropological. The government, or the QA benchmarks for anthropology and history, we do find shared points, such as the need to understand other cultures, which is very important for this kind of area, as I think in study of religions as a whole, because in our society, particularly amongst certain sections of the media and the educated white middle class, there is a tendency to mock anything which is strange and different.
Mm-hmm.
And of course it's anti-scholarly, anti-intellectual. And astrology is one area which tends to be mocked.
Well, it's to mock something that's strange and different, yet it's so familiar. It's something that is there in our culture the whole time. I was wondering what you thought it said about modernity, and in particular when you were talking earlier on. I mean, have you read Martin Stringer's work on situational belief? It's a great little book, came out a couple of years ago, and he talks about, it was based on anthropological work amongst a group of Christians, and he found that in certain circumstances, they would agree to believe in things which were quite contradictory. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for instance, they didn't believe in life after death or whatever when they were asked under most circumstances, but when discussing their dead relatives, they would express the idea that they somehow still existed and could possibly come back. So they would express reincarnation in certain situations, but they wouldn't have stated that that was their belief. And do you think that... do you think that sounds similar to the situation with astrology?
It is. It's the situation one finds with ghosts as well. This word belief is highly problematic.
Indeed.
In the, I think the Enlightenment project, which was basically anti-institution religion, the challenge to religion as a whole became, crystallized around the ontological notion of the difference between knowing and belief.
Yeah.
And so belief then becomes automatically false. Or if you believe something, that the object of belief is necessarily false. And this then leads at the extreme to certain physicists postulating the notion that belief is a result of not just psychological inadequacy or social marginality, but actual malfunctions in the brain. So I think it's, I think it, I would call that pseudoscience, actually. But, so, what happens then, as various people, particularly Hufford, who I think is great, have pointed out, is that disbelief is privileged in Western society. And if you say you believe something, there's a risk that you're going to be thought stupid. And so if people are asked if they believe in astrology, there are often two possible answers. One is, yes, I believe it, and therefore I'm stupid. Or the other is, no, I don't believe it, and if they are practicing astrology, therefore I'm a charlatan. So the question is loaded. And I was very influenced by Gillian Bennett's work on ghosts, where she found that if people are asked if they believe in ghosts, they may say no, but then on further conversation, they might say, yes, but Uncle Albert comes to stand at the foot of the bed every Sunday.
Mm. And even without that, most people still get frightened in a rickety old house in the middle of the night.
Exactly. So in other words, when people ask if they believe something, then the answers are invariably going to be conditioned by their own expectations of what the questioner wants to hear. And so I asked a lot of astrologers the question, if you were asked whether you believe in astrology, what would your answer be and can you explain? And so I offered four answers, yes, no, don't know, or other. Now, what was interesting was that whatever answer people gave, they say, well, the reason is because I know it works. So, yes, I believe in astrology because I know it works, or no, I don't believe in astrology because I know it works. So the whole notion of knowing and believing in our society is so mixed up and so confused, it's such a mess, mm-hmm. Because of this Enlightenment project, that I prefer to abandon the word belief altogether. Mm-hmm. It's not a helpful concept. As far as modernity is concerned, I don't think modernity is a helpful concept either. Stephen Sutcliffe called the New Age an emblem. And so I think that's a great word, much richer word than, say, label. So for me, modernity and postmodernity are just emblems. People gather political, social, religious, industrial, technological trends into one sort of great bucket and say that's modernity. And then they contrast them by alternate trends, another bucket they call postmodernity. It's all a huge, great mess. I'll give you an example. If you look at modern art, which is the art of modernity, abstract art, surrealism. You look at the artists, a lot of them were theosophists. Kandinsky, the founder of abstract art, devout theosophist. He was, in his abstraction, portraying a theosophical vision of the cosmos. André Breton, founder of surrealism, a practicing astrologer. So the notion of modernity is somehow counter to theosophy or astrology in those two examples, it just doesn't work. I mean, you know, people, postmodernists who don't like modernity talk about modernity as authoritarian, espousing a single truth. But I mean, political modernity, if you have such a thing, is about liberal democracy, and it's about multiple truths. So the whole argument, the arguments collapse. So I actually would see theosophical astrology as modernizing. And that's what the theosophical astrologers themselves say. They simplified astrology, they streamlined it, and they did so because they were creating an astrology which would be suitable for the new age, the coming era. I mean, that's modernizing. So if we have to have an astrology of modernity, if we do have to, it's theosophical and it's new age, which is completely contrary to what people normally say, which is that new age is postmodern and so on. I just think these debates are so muddled because they're obsessed with categories rather than the evidence of what people actually say and do. And I think good scholarship should focus on data and evidence rather than categorisation.
Well, that's absolutely something that we at the Religious Studies Project would agree with you. And this is clearly a very rich subject, but I'm afraid we're going to have to stop there. So I'll say thank you very much, Dr. Campion.
Thank you very much indeed.
You have just been listening to an interview that David recorded with Nick Campion at the BASR conference in Winchester last September. Just before that, another interview was recorded by Knut, one of our other interviewers. You may remember his interview with Wouter Hanegraaff. If not, check it out. That has been one of our most popular podcasts of late. But he also interviewed in Stockholm Jim Lewis on new approaches to new religious movements. So if you know anything about new religious movements, you should know the name of James Lewis. So I'm really looking forward to hearing that interview. Apart from that, we have confirmed our plans for Christmas. We're going to be recording a Christmas special, but we'll keep the details of that hush-hush for now. But we're really excited about what we're potentially going to produce. I shouldn't be selling it so strongly because it mightn't work, but if it does, it'll be great. You can keep checking out the responses on the website, our Facebook and Twitter pages, and indeed the comments section on the website, which is now open again after sort of some brief technical issues. Also, at the weekend there, we just published our first set of book reviews in the form of a book review roundtable podcast and then the individual reviews. So if you're interested in checking that out, I would thoroughly recommend it. There's four highly distinctive books that we go through, a variety of opinions, and a lot of good ensuing discussion as well. So we'd be delighted if you check that out and let us know what you think, so that we can maybe do that again in future. But for now, I am going to leave you and say, as ever, thanks for listening.